I'm Matt Finifter. I'm here today to present Jigsaw, efficient low-effort mashup isolation. This is work with James Mickens that I did last summer while I was working with him at Microsoft Research. So I'd like you to pretend for a moment that you're a web developer, and maybe some of you are, and you're tasked with writing a new web application. So in addition to its main functionality, whatever that might be, your application has to pull in ads from an ad network, okay? It has to have some great social integration and, you know, like the ability to like or maybe to plus one something. It has to also pull in countless JavaScript libraries, which might include something like an analytics library or maybe something like jQuery, to help you deal with sort of the sheer terror that is the browser platform as it stands today. So, you know, the question is, how do you tell all these components to talk to one another? Do you give all of this third-party code free rein to do sort of anything that your own code that you trust is able to do? And even if you trust the developers of the third-party code not to be malicious, do you trust them to have written their code correctly such that it is completely invulnerable to attack? And so the point here, of course, is security. You know, ideally, from a security perspective, we want to be able to completely isolate all of this third-party code and then control exactly what we share with it, right? The problem, of course, is that a developer's objective is typically to make the code work with as little effort as possible, right? So our goal, if we care about security, is to minimize the effort the developer has to go to in order to correctly isolate the code and control what is shared with it. So now that I've oriented you a little bit to the problem space I'll be talking about, here's the outline for the rest of my talk. I'll talk first about a few of the many previous approaches to solving this problem and why we think they aren't sufficient. I'll talk about our goals and how they informed our design. And then I'll give some details about implementation and evaluation before I wrap up. So first, a little bit about previous approaches to the problem. One obvious approach is to sort of do nothing. And what I mean by this is directly include any third-party code and content into your site, for example, with a simple JavaScript source equals tag. And this gives the code complete access to anything and everything that your own code can do. So this is really easy to do. It's what you'll do if you don't know any better, if you don't know about sort of the concept of mashup isolation. The downside, of course, is that a security breach in any component means a breach of absolutely everything. So an attacker who mounts a successful cross-site scripting attack, for example, against your analytics library, can go ahead and take any action the user can take, right? And so this is bad for obvious reasons. This can cause a lot of damage to your user base and to your product on the whole. So another option is to use iframes for isolation and to use PostMessage for controlled sharing between the components. This is really great because it is standardized. It's available in every modern web browser. Iframes provide strong isolation. And PostMessage is a communication primitive that's really, really simple to understand. There's only one operation. You send strings, right? Super simple. On the negative side, you know, developers are forced into an asynchronous programming model. And you know, this is fine for some applications, but it turns out this can be absolutely a world of pain for others. And I'll get into in a little bit an example of how this can hurt you. So in addition, sort of except for the most basic of applications, developers usually need to layer something on top of PostMessage anyway, something more complex, something more useful. Passing objects across isolation boundaries is often necessary. And this can, in fact, introduce high performance overheads because you have to marshal and unmarshal the objects to actually make this work. So another approach is to use one of the many previous mashup isolation frameworks that are already out there. You know, ours is not the first one by any means. And so this includes things like Google's Caja project, something Doug worked on, AdSafe, two systems by Majerovic et al. One's called Object Views and the other one's called Conscript. These systems are all great. We probably couldn't have done what we did without their existence. I'm happy they exist. But they all suffer, I think, from the fact that the policies tend to be pretty complex and difficult for developers to actually get right. So additionally, you know, each of these systems does have some combination of performance and compatibility implications. The same will be true of our system, but I do feel compelled to mention it. So I think this leads nicely to a discussion of the design goals for our system, which we call Jigsaw. The first, as you might guess, is isolation by default. This is sort of the baseline that gives us strong security properties and that we build off of in order to build a controlled sharing interface between different principles. The next is simplicity. So I mentioned that policies in a lot of these other systems tend to be pretty complex. So we started off with the idea that policies can and should be easy for developers to write. And as you'll see, we utilize the concepts of public and private variables, which we think developers are already pretty familiar with from other languages like Java, in conjunction with a simple policy language that deals in high-level resources like, for example, network access. The next goal is efficient synchronous sharing. So as I said, I'll get into more detail about why we want this. And I'll go into, of course, what the mechanism looks like. But this expresses our desire for a synchronous programming model. We think this is easier for developers to understand and easier for developers to reason about. And it does, in fact, help with performance because of what I mentioned before, the marshalling and unmarshalling overheads for objects. And our final design goal is fail-safe legacy code. We want plain old JavaScript code code that's not aware of Jigsaw, to work as expected whenever possible, and to fail safely otherwise. So going into our design, I'll start with some terminology. I have a little diagram up here. That is what we'll call a principle hierarchy. A principle, as we define it, is an instance of web content. So this can come from some domain and includes HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. It might have all of these, it might have some of these, it might have only JavaScript, doesn't really matter. They exist in a hierarchy, as I say. The user visits what we call the integrator principle. This is the sort of top-level principle that the user knows that they're interacting with. And this principle might include any number of other principles and on down the line. Each one of these is placed into what we call a box, which is our unit of isolation. Okay, great. So what's in a box? Each box has a bunch of resources associated with it, all these things you see up here on the slide. JavaScript namespace, DOM tree, event loop, a visual region, a network connection, and a local storage area. And so, you know, those of you who are familiar with iframes might say, oh, wow, this sounds, you know, awfully familiar to an iframe. And you would be right, and that's great. There are a few important differences, though, which I'll go into now. So the first big difference is that boxes from the same origin are actually isolated from one another by default. And so this is not true with same origin iframes, which are able to access each other's resources by default. So this difference enables fault isolation as well as privilege separation for different components that originate from the same origin. And privilege separation is a well-established thing dating back several years that we think is good for security, right? The second big difference is that is the nesting of permissions in boxes. So any box can include any other box, but it can only ever give the box it includes a subset of its own resources. So for example, the integrator principle might be able to make HTTP requests to any domain. It might include a principle that can contact only .coms, and that principle might include another principle that can only contact one specific .com. So as I say, a principle can only ever grant another principle a strict subset, a subset of the resources that it has. The third major difference is that boxes communicate synchronously. The difference being that iframes use the asynchronous message passing interface called PostMessage. So I keep going on about trying to avoid an asynchronous programming model. What is it specifically that we don't like about asynchronous programming? I'll go into an example now that I think demonstrates why you at least want to have the option of using a synchronous programming model. So imagine you have n pieces of data, and you want to process them with some external library. So an easy and sane way to write the code might look something like this. Simple for loop, call on the external library, grab the result, stuff it into another array. You know, this is great. I'm pretty sure this is right. Yes. Okay. So now imagine that you can only call your external library through an asynchronous interface. For each item you tell it to process, you have to give it a callback that will get executed when it finishes, which tells it to process the next item, right? And so that might look something like this. Maybe? Is this right? I think it is. I know it's a lot harder to tell if this is right than it was for the synchronous version. It was also a lot harder for me to write this version than the first version. So, my face might have looked something like this during that process. Keep in mind, this is really kind of as simple as these examples come. When you're already contending with the complexity of an actual real program, using a synchronous programming model, or at least being able to when you want to, can make a huge difference in your own sanity and in the readability of your code for others. So the next part of the design is principal objects. Each principal has one of these objects, and this object serves as the public interface to a principal. In order to call some method that a principal has exposed, you get a handle to the principal object that you want, and you call the public method on the object. So Jigsaw defines a few things that are useful for this. One is a getParentPrinciple method for the calling principal to get the object for its parent principal. And it also defines this principal's array, which contains the child principal objects for the calling principal. Next is the DOM tree and visual field. So each box can have its own DOM tree and visual field, so long as its parent principal actually delegated some visual field to it. So if not, the box actually is unable to add new DOM nodes. And the way that a parent grants a visual field to a child is using a CSS style syntax. So specifying the width, height, location, and Z order of the delegated visual field. The parent is free to change the child's visual field however it wants. And the child can also try to change its own visual field, but this is subject to approval by the parent. So the parent will have an event fired that says, okay, the child's trying to change its visual field, do you approve this, yes or no? Next up is network access. This is yet another resource that a parent can give to a child, and it's specified quite simply as a whitelist of accessible domains with wildcards allowed. So as you might expect by now, this is monotonically decreasing. A parent can't grant a child access to more domains than it has access to itself. So perhaps the most complex resource to try and share between between principles is stuff in the JavaScript namespace, right? So so objects and calling somebody else's methods and things like this. The way Jigsaw handles this is it adds two new keywords to the JavaScript language, public and private. These are similar to, for example, what they do in JavaScript and C#, but unlike in those languages, here they have strong security properties. And what they do is they effectively define a subset of an object graph that will cross an isolation boundary when this object graph is passed across. And I'll note, of course, that variables are private by default, so things can't accidentally traverse an isolation boundary. So I'll try to make this a little more clear by giving a simple example. If a principle X creates this object you see up here, public property P and private property Q, and it passes it over to another principle, principle Y, then what principle Y actually sees and thinks it has is this object. So it's an object with only property P. If Y goes ahead and enumerates the properties on this object, it won't see Q at all. It won't have any clue that Q ever existed. And this happens fully automatically based on just these public and private annotations. So the way this is actually enforced is by something that we call surrogate objects. And the surrogates are what are actually passed between boxes instead of passing raw objects between boxes. So the way a surrogate is created is you take an initially empty object, and this is the Jigsaw library doing this, you take an initially empty object and you add getters and setters for each property that has been declared public. So the getters and setters look something like this. A getter for public property P of an object returns create surrogate of obj.p, and the setter creates a surrogate for the value before setting it. So this creation of surrogates during the getting and setting process is what actually ensures that all objects that cross the boundary both ways are surrogates and not raw objects, okay? So, you know, in case you ignored me for the last few slides, here's a summary of the design. You have principles, and these principles are isolated by default into what we call boxes. Each box has a principal object, which defines the interface that other boxes can use. And public and private keywords define the subset of an object graph that will traverse an isolation boundary between boxes. High-level resources like network access, visual field, are explicitly granted from a parent to a child using simple policy language. So I'll give you now sort of an overview of the implementation of Jigsaw. The two pieces are a Jigsaw to JavaScript compiler as well as a client-side library. The compiler translates these private and public keywords into operations on a per-object map of visibility metadata. So it's keeping track for each object, whether it's actually public or private. And this is what's consulted later when the surrogates are created. So it adds calls into the runtime library to actually create the surrogates for the objects passed between boxes. It also keeps track of object IDs and box IDs so that it can be a little more clever about creating surrogates, so that it'll create at most one surrogate for any given raw object. And then another clever thing it does using these IDs is that it's able to actually unwrap a surrogate if that surrogate is in fact passed back to the box that it initially came from, right? So this maintains properties that we want, like reference comparison, right? And there are more details about this, of course, in the paper. So the library, which is the second piece, defines the interface for creating a new box. So this is what code that you write would actually use. You call into jigsaw.createBox to tell it to create a new principle. It implements box creation by loading the Jigsaw code for the new box within the context of a Jigsaw function that redefines all the standard globals. So things like window and document. And these redefined globals talk to, of course, the real versions of window and document, et cetera, only after passing through all the jigsaw security checks for things like network access and visual field. So, you know, effectively we're virtualizing these global objects. I'll note here on this slide that the current prototype implements the majority of the design that I described, but not actually all of it. The biggest missing piece is full DOM tree virtualization, which, as you might imagine, is quite complex. So, you know, implementing this stuff is really hard. For example, you have the Caja team who's worked on this for several years, and it's getting it right is a tough problem that we don't claim to have solved. So now I'll go a little bit into evaluation. I'll talk about sort of what it looks like to port a library from JavaScript to Jigsaw in order to get these strong isolation properties. What we found was that a lot of libraries already have what you can consider sort of a de facto principal object. So an object that sort of already defines what looks like a public interface, already defines functions that are, you know, very clearly for public consumption. And so, you know, we took this and we said, okay, well, this is the principal object, right? We told Jigsaw this is the principal object. So the next step was to figure out which properties, you know, in this huge library should be public and which should be private. In other words, you know, when we're passing something across a boundary, what subset of the object graph should actually traverse the boundary? So we use actually a modified runtime to help us with this effort. The modified runtime allowed all objects to cross box boundaries. You know, we didn't mark anything at first. It would allow everything. Everything's by default private. Allow everything to cross the boundaries, but generate logs as private variables are crossing the boundary. And so what this did is that, you know, we got these logs that showed us, okay, well, these are the things that are actually crossing a boundary under regular use. And so what this let us do is quickly identify this set of properties that need to be marked public in order for the library to continue to work. And I'll mention also that we didn't explicitly need to sanitize objects, right? The surrogate mechanism is automatic. It takes care of this for us. So we didn't explicitly sanitize objects, which is really cool. And, you know, this contrasts with something like Caja, where you do. You actually have to say, okay, well, you know, I want to sanitize this object before I pass it to somebody else. And now I'll go into performance a little bit. This first chart that I'm showing looks at how long it takes to pass an object graph from one principal to another in two different cases. So the first case is what you might see for something like PostMessage, where you have to actually serialize an object on one end and deserialize it on the other end. And the second case is the Jigsaw surrogate creation mechanism. So we have object graphs of three different sizes, 155 nodes, 315 nodes, and 635 nodes. And you know, you can sort of see what's going on here, right? This gets bad for big object graphs when you have to serialize and deserialize them. And this isn't even including the post-message time. So this is really just the object serialization, deserialization. Jigsaw, on the other hand, is really efficient because the surrogates are actually lazily created. So when you pass, when you initially share an object graph, you only have one single surrogate that's created at that time for the root of the object graph, okay? But what happens later on is that the surrogates are lazily created when they're accessed. So there is a little bit of a slowdown sort of later on. It's kind of a trade-off. But where you get a really big win is when you share large object graphs where only a small subset of the objects are actually accessed, right? So you'll have this huge object graph and not many surrogates, relatively speaking, will be created using Jigsaw. So we also looked at end-to-end performance that comes from the extra security checks, the bookkeeping tasks, the virtualization of the global objects and the DOM nodes, like I mentioned. And so this figure shows the results for four different Jigsaw-enabled applications. The details of what they actually do can be found in the paper, but what you'll see here is we have up to 12x performance overhead, which is not great, but it's sort of similar to other rewriting-based schemes like Kaha. So here's a list of some related work. I won't go into detail about each one of these like we do in the paper, but I think the biggest takeaway when you're comparing Jigsaw to other related work is our focus on the programming model. So our focus on what it looks like for a developer to actually try and share a limited number of resources between otherwise isolated principles. So we think we give developers a pretty easy and largely familiar way to control the sharing, while these other systems have not focused on this quite as much. On the other side, though, a lot of these systems are actually deployed. A lot of them have more mature implementations than Jigsaw does, for sure. And we can acknowledge that there is some more implementation work to do in order to make Jigsaw production ready, like some of these other systems are. So to wrap up, I've presented the design and implementation of Jigsaw and a little bit of evaluation. And Jigsaw is a new framework for mashup isolation, which focuses on efficiency as well as low developer effort. Jigsaw policies are simple to write. They deal with public and private JavaScript objects as well as high-level browser resources like visual regions and network communication. Jigsaw presents a synchronous programming model, which, as hopefully I've convinced you, is oftentimes a lot simpler to write and to reason about compared to an asynchronous model like the one you get with iframes plus postmessage. And finally, Jigsaw uses this novel surrogate mechanism for enforcing the public and private semantics of JavaScript objects that cross isolation boundaries. So with that, I thank you very much for listening to me, and I'll open the floor to questions.
We have almost 2 minutes for questions. Who's the next
speaker? Hi, Michael Schick, Naval Postgraduate School. What kind of state is this in? Is it available to play around with or anything like that?
That might be a question for James.
So the answer to that is we're currently working on developing it and sort of making it production ready.
Yep.
And so there are actually a couple different efforts at Microsoft to create, for lack of a better term, JavaScript++ with the policies to Doug. So we're still trying to see how it fits into that.
Okay.
But let's talk afterwards and we'll see if we can do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. I didn't really do anything, but you're welcome.
Doug mentioned the new operator let that's mm-hmm. going to happen in JavaScript. Will it impact help you here? Because it will change the scope from, I guess, function to block, I think.
Let's see. Will that impact us? The answer is yes. The complexity of JavaScript is already there. And a new operator like let, I think, will impact us. I would have to sit down with a piece of paper to think about exactly how.
Would it help you or hinder you? I think it should help you, right?
It might be able to help. I mean, there are also efforts like ES5 Strict that do help. These efforts to eliminate parts of the language certainly help. They make things a lot easier. So let might fall into that category. Yeah. Thanks.